The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. The man who we're going to deal with tonight is probably, whether you agree with him or not, probably the single most interesting philosopher in Russia and Eastern Europe, and quite possibly the most interesting philosopher of all time. The reason that that's the case is that here is a man who is very Russian Orthodox, very Russian, and in fact, at the end of his life, became a monk at the Optina Monastery just outside Moscow. And yet, within that, he is heavily influenced by and uses pretty regularly the work of Friedrich Nietzsche in his philosophical writing. And you would think that the last person in the world who would be heavily influenced by Nietzsche would be a monastic. But this is the case. I myself have been heavily influenced by Nietzsche over the years, clearly not in his religious thought, but the religious aspect is a part of a much larger and very profound critique. Now, I've read at one point or another everything that Nietzsche ever wrote, and it is not a systematic philosophy. That was not his point. He was aphoristic, and he created a series of thought-provoking propositions rather than a coherent doctrine. That was not his purpose, and he was opposed to the concept of creating a cohesive doctrine. You can think of people like Nietzsche and Plato as those who give you the tools to approach a doctrine, but not in and of itself a doctrine or a set of dogmas, or a set of ideas. It's an approach to ideas. And I think that's one thing that Plato and Nietzsche have in common. I did my master's thesis on Nietzsche's Zarathustra, and I compared it to certain elements in Hegel's theory of the state in the philosophy of right. And I've always thought that Nietzsche was radically misunderstood, and most of the people who talk about him have never read him or have read a few things here and there. Studying philosophy is not something that you can just dive into. One of my problems with a lot of beginners and amateurs who try to deal with these extremely difficult and profound thinkers, especially in Germany, is that they have no method. They don't know how to go about approaching a complex and difficult philosopher. And so they just kind of read without any method. They kind of read randomly. Now, the problem with that approach should be self-evident, but there is a very specific reason why that's a problem. Now, some writers are worse than others in this regard, but the history of philosophy is loaded with people who utilized a very technical and rather idiosyncratic vocabulary. Now, if you just pick up something and start reading it, most often, if not always, this vocabulary is going to elude you. So in other words, they use words and phrases that we may take in a certain ordinary way in our day-to-day language, but that is not how these people are using it. So examples are everywhere. And someone like Immanuel Kant, words like manifold and category and synthetic, for example, are used everywhere in the Critique of Pure Reason. We use those words and phrases sometimes, but we don't use them in the highly technical way that Kant was using them. Hegel, for example, was probably the most notorious for this, where his whole corpus is based around the very technical use of kind of ordinary words. For him, words like concept, force, idea, absolute, will, state. We use those words almost every day. Hegel uses them in a way very different from how we would use them in our daily conversation. So if you just pick up one of these people and start reading, you're reading these words that, you know, you think you know the meaning of, but they are not using it in that way. So just sitting down and picking up somebody is probably not the best way to go about it. You need a guide. You need someone to teach you how to structure your studies and focus your mind in one area or another to make it all coherent. The problem with Nietzsche is that because he did not have, nor did he attempt to create, a systematic approach to philosophy or ethics, it's very difficult to just pick something up. The problem with Nietzsche is that he is deceptively easy. The same I could say for Plato. You read the aphorisms in Zarathustra, for example, and they come across as rather ordinary, profound observations, forgetting that he's using them in a very specific context, in a very idiosyncratic way. So, for example, if you pick up The Gay Science, which is one of my favorite Nietzschean books, he kind of assumes that his reader is going to be very familiar with Kant and Hegel, is going to be familiar with Greek metaphysics, and to a great extent, familiar with the Greek language and how it developed through writers like Homer. Nietzsche's doctoral degree is in classical philology, the study of languages, study of classical languages. So he assumes that his readers are going to have some background in this area. And so he's referring to specific concepts in the Gay Science, for example, that are directly derived from Kant. He might not necessarily alert you of that. And so he's writing as a part of a community of critique of all of that that Kant had provoked in the 19th century. And you will not understand the fullness of what he's trying to say because he's part of that stream, that community of thought, and finding his place within it. And so that's why when you pick up somebody, you are dealing with a context, a technical vocabulary, and a technical method that you have to know first before you even begin to read the person. Nietzsche is notorious for this because he is unsystematic. When you begin Friedrich Nietzsche, my recommendation, first of all, is to start at the beginning. Read The Birth of Tragedy. You read The Birth of Tragedy, a lot of what later develops as that which is specifically Nietzschean will be clear. That's probably the best way to do it. After that, I would then go to The Gay Science. I think really The Gay Science is the summation and the hardest core of the Nietzschean doctrine. Leontief was heavily influenced by Nietzsche. Like me, he took Nietzsche primarily as somebody who can be used to critique, to attack, to destroy for what Leontief considered the greatest evil of all time. The greatest evil in that it's the summation of all previous evils, and that is the bourgeoisie, the middle class as it developed in the West. More than anything else, he wanted to protect the Russia that he deeply loved, the royal house that he deeply loved, and the church that he deeply loved from this corrosive influence. Capitalism and the bourgeoisie, the middle class, the so-called entrepreneurial spirit, is the most destructive ideologies and approaches, really more of a mindset than anything else, to civilization. It is, in his mind, a direct attack on civilization as such, and it corrodes the foundations, the pillars upon which civilization rests, civilization of any kind. For him, the Western bourgeoisie was obsessed with bureaucracy, with standardization, with uniformity, with purely quantitative measures. They thought only in quantitative terms. They thought in terms of dollars and cents. They thought in terms of votes, populations, markets, advertising, popularity, trade, formal bureaucratic establishments. They reduced all reality to that extremely prosaic foundation. Leontief uses Nietzsche and is influenced by Nietzsche, as was I, primarily as a battering ram, to use against that mentality. He's willing to suffer anything. Any ideology can be imposed on a country. Anything but that. Anything but the middle class idea. Anything to avoid the standardized, quantitative, conformist mentality of the businessman, of the middle class professional, where all metaphysics, all poetry, all religion has been corroded away, not so much because they hate it, not so much because they have a problem with it, but because they vulgarize it in that it cannot be fit readily into their way of life. So, for example, when I was in high school and I decided that I was going to do the history of philosophy and the history of political philosophy, and by my senior year, I was pretty dedicated to this thing that I was going to do. This is going to be my life. And you know how it is. You go to people and you say, this is what I'm going to major in New England, and this is what I'm going to do. And the first thing they say to you is, what are you going to do with that? And after a while, I got very impatient, because the implication is that education is only so that you can go out into the business world and make money. That's what education is. That's what society is. That's what the world is. That's why human beings are here. And there's that famous quote, I can't off the top of my head remember who said it, that all of the wars and all of the philosophy, all of the poetry and the political theory, from the Greek Empire to the Mongols to the Persians to the Romans, all the science, all the civilization that has developed, and all the death and sacrifice that that civilization has demanded over the millennia, all of this apparently existed so that the vulgar middle class capitalist man can sit in the library and read the newspaper. All of that happened so that the middle class man could make a couple of bucks in his shop or in his profession. Because that's all, really, that these people are about. And they take the highest expressions of civilization and they drag it down to the most prosaic, quantitative way of life and thought. Everything is about how something is going to be good for business, how something is going to improve their standing and reputation in the economy and in the society. Everything good and strong and virtuous is destroyed and corroded by this mentality. For Leontief, everything, the evils of the modern world, can be reduced to this way of life. It's materialist in kind of the eccentric sense. Not so much that really all they think about is money all day long, because some of them certainly do not. But that everything that is important to the virtues, to the life of civilization, gets reduced to whatever it is that's good for business. Whatever it is that's good to get elected and to get a good job and to keep a good job and to impress your boss. Your entire world revolves around that. And that is almost completely omnipresent, except for a few of us who have dedicated at great sacrifice to live the life of daily struggle and daily spiritual warfare as poorly as people like me could do it. Nevertheless, we have gone out of our way to reject and hold the bourgeois life in absolute contempt. And usually we do it in the face of either the hostility or the incomprehending stares of that mediocre, bureaucratic, middle-class world. That when you get right down to it, you're born, you go to school, you get an education, you work for somebody for 10 hours a day, you retire at 70, and you die. That's the point of your life, this absurd mediocrity, a mockery of what life in the world of the spirit really is. Konstantin Leontiev dies in 1891. It's 9 years before Nietzsche. Leontiev is one of Nietzsche's first and most significant European followers and supporters. He didn't take Nietzsche's criticism of Christianity all that serious because, remember, when you read Nietzsche on this particular topic, Jesus Christ for Nietzsche is a great man. For Nietzsche, Jesus Christ was an archetypal culture and civilization creator. His problem wasn't with Christ. His problem was with his followers. He says the same thing about science. He says it's one thing to venerate the memory of the great scientific minds, you know, your Keplers and your Galens and your Hippocrates, your Bacons and all of these major figures. These are culture creators. These are men who destroyed what came before and slowly began to build something that was new. They were revolutionaries in the most useful and humane sense of the word. But that's different from a man of science. The man of science is some bureaucrat who works for a salary in a laboratory and does what he's told. And he works for 8 hours a day, and then he retires at 65, and then he waits to die. This is what he does. He's not a thinker. He's just a bureaucrat. He does what he's told. And it's the same thing in Nietzsche's relation. Christ to him was a great critic, a great prophet. He was a man of tremendous moral ability. The problem is, and you see this with writers like Nikolai Berdyaev and many others, that no matter how great a founder of a school always ends up being some bureaucratic mediocrity. No matter how great the founder is, these ideas end up becoming systematized. And when they're systematized and turned into an ideology, they then become a set of dogma that you have to repeat and repeat and repeat. Whether or not you know anything doesn't matter. So long as you repeat the right slogans, it becomes a bureaucratized, mediocre approach to the world. And you accept it because you want to fit in and you want to get a good job and you want to be able to retire and not have to worry about anything. That's why you repeat it. I know, and I've said this before, many academics in the fields that I've taught at the university in philosophy, political science, and history, these academics that accept liberalism and this diversity nonsense and secularism and materialism and atheism and all this stuff, they accept it not because they truly believe it or because they care, but this is how you get tenure. And these people, had they become a plumber or an electrician, would be probably normal conservative types. But because they're in academia, they spout the slogans because they don't want the conflict. And, you know, you get hired and promoted in academia for one reason. Not because you're good, not because you're a good teacher. In fact, good teachers are a threat. No, it's somebody who can fit into the department bureaucracy and the bureaucracy of the institution as a whole. No matter how good you are, if you rock the boat, you are in trouble. It's not about the truth. It's not about criticism. It's not even about the open exchange of ideas. It's a warm body going into a classroom, following the curriculum, and then going home. That's what it's about. But no matter how exalted they may speak of themselves, whether it be in religion or in science or in the academy or in anything else, no matter how exalted they may view their mission to be, ultimately, the overwhelming majority of their movement ends up being very mediocre bureaucrats who spout the line and collect their paychecks. This, Leontiev says, is unique to modernity. It is the creation of the modern world, because the applied science and technology demands uniformity. If you make a machine, you have to make spare parts. Those spare parts have to be able to be installed and work identically as the part that it's replacing. The modern technocratic mind is one that is absolutely quantitative and mediocre. Your role is to act as the cog in the wheel of the machine. A machine is dead. It is inorganic. It is a pathetic and pale imitation of creation, of the organic system of the world. And they're trying to replace it with the machine. And ultimately what they do is to turn individuals into machines, into the standardized mechanism of the bureaucratic organization. This, for Leontief, and I do agree with him, is specifically unique to the modern world because technocracy is specifically unique to the modern world. Standardization, uniformity, and mediocrity. Regardless of the brilliance of the founders of this way of life, that's what happens when their ideas become bureaucratized. Now, that's the negative side. The positive side of Leontief is struggling, and he does believe that this is a rear guard action, even in a society as traditional and royalist and agrarian as Russia. So could you imagine if he were living in America in 2012, what he would say? He's complaining about this stuff at the end of 19th century Russia, of all places. The main concept that motivates everything that Leontief does is beauty. Beauty with a capital B. And I mean that specifically because when you capitalize a word like that, beauty or truth, you're referring to a Platonic form. You're referring to beauty with a capital B that collects the qualities of every specific thing in the world that's beautiful and takes what all of them have in common and abstracts it into the ultimate essence of what beauty is. That's what we mean when we say truth with a capital T or goodness with a capital G. It is the form, it is the essence of all the specific manifestations of a beautiful thing or a good act. That is the ultimate aspect, essence of all reality and our purpose in this earth. His concept of science is that, of course, science is destructive because it demands that everything that it looks at and analyzed be standardized and reduced to numbers and equations. And he looks at nature and he says, well, it's true that there's an aspect of reality that can be measured that way. That does not exhaust the whole of reality. And yet scientific practitioners in his day have become such mechanized bureaucrats in their approach to things that they can't see nature as anything but just one big machine. They can't look at nature as an organism. They cannot. Their method assumes that nature is a machine, and there is absolutely nothing that an organism and a mechanism have in common. They're two completely different methods of understanding reality. And yet, the great French writers like Le Maître and others, he wrote The Human Machine, everything in the world, whether it be the oceans or the brain or mankind or civilization, all of this can be understood only by reducing it to the level of simple quantitative cause and effect. Everything is at the level of the machine, and they have the audacity to say that anything that is not reducible to a machine does not exist, or is a figment of your imagination, or it's a superstition. This is your classic positivist approach to the world, and it is absolutely destructive in a way that no revolutionary government could ever be. A revolutionary government can produce someone like Solzhenitsyn, who spent much of his life attacking this point of view. No, the bourgeois bureaucratic takeover reduces even the very concept and the possibility of producing someone like a Solzhenitsyn. The fact is that that mentality is absolutely mysterious to the modern man, because the only thing that the modern man knows is numbers, quantity, and mechanism. Okay, I'm going to stop now. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get deep, or as deep as possible, into the positive doctrine of Konstantin Leontiev.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. Tonight we are talking about the philosophy and the concept of the philosophy of history and civilization in the mind of Konstantin Leontiev. As an aside, many of you may have noticed that on my program page here at the Voice of Reason, I have added a donation button to put donations into my PayPal account. Those of you who know me know how much I hate money. I hate thinking about money. I hate having to ask for money. I hate talking about money. I hate what money does to people. I hate what money forces people to do that they would never do normally. I hate the absolute obsession and fetishization that the modern world has with money. But at the same time, I am engaged in substantial long-term research projects that require that I have at least some extra money to pay the expenses that go into both the philosophical and religious aspects of my work. If you donate to me, that money, and I promise you, will go either to the church and my chapel and related things concerning that, or my research and expenses that are specifically to my travel or anything else that I have to do to put all this stuff together for the radio show, my articles, books, and everything else. And so I appeal to you to help me out in any way you can. I do not have a university financing me. I do not get government grants. The big foundations, whether corporate or the old money foundations, do not give me any money. The religious foundations certainly are not going to give me any money. The church that I belong to is very poor in America. My metropolitan lives in poverty, as I've told you before. And of course, at the same time, I do not claim an IRS tax exemption for the fact that I have a church, a parish. I do not claim a tax exemption for that. I refuse to allow the government to regulate my work, because if I claim a tax exemption, the government then takes over and dictates exactly what I can and cannot do concerning the church life. The big foundations have a tax exemption. Universities have a tax exemption. This is all to be able to control the function of these institutions. It's not a benefit, at least in my opinion. Anyway, so I ask you to be as generous as you think you can. And I thank you very much for it, as much as I hate asking. Anyway, we're talking about Konstantin Leontiev and his use of Nietzsche in dealing with his critique of the greatest of all evils, and that is the modern middle-class bourgeois mentality. But the heart of his positive doctrine is the highest object, the very essence of divinity, to the extent that we can comprehend it at all, is not goodness or truth, but beauty. Beauty comes first. Truth and goodness derive directly from it. Beauty is not only the center of reality, but the highest possible expression of reality. We ended before the break talking about Leontief's general philosophy of science. And one of the things that lies at the center here is that each object, each organism coming into existence has to follow, according to its DNA, and all the other chemical structures that dictate how an organism is to flourish. Apart from that, every organism seeks to manifest itself as uniquely as possible within its basic chemical structure. The opposite of beauty is not ugliness. The opposite of beauty is mediocrity. In a small way, beauty is a legitimate approach to unity in diversity, diversity in unity. There is a form, there is a structure that all organisms have to follow. But that is not exhaustive of the definition, the essence of what an organism is. Every organism seeks to, of course, survive and flourish. But more specifically, it seeks to flourish in the most unique way possible relative to its essence. As I've said before, logos, the word, is the structure and organization of all creation, all of the infinite interrelations of all forces in the cosmos, forming a unity. That is logos. It is the second person in the Trinity. It is an ancient philosophical pre-Christian concept. It is the center of all the ancient perennial wisdom. No matter what part of the planet you're on, some approach to logos as that rational center, the reason that is present in all things. That is the unity. How the different aspects of this organism function and flourish, that is the diversity. Both have to function at the same time. The greatest height of civilization is the maximum level of unity with the maximum level of diversity. Put differently, it's the maximum flourishing of diverse elements in a society, but that being accomplished within the greatest level of unity of purpose. In other words, even more differently than that, the concept is unity does not and never can imply sameness. Unity is not uniformity. In fact, diversity has no purpose unless it is unified. Unless diverse phenomenon, whether it be in philosophy or in science, the only reason that we should care at all is that there is this inner logic that holds it all together. Our appreciation of beauty, though, is pristine. It's primordial. It's emotional and instinctive. Our appreciation of beauty goes straight to the heart of our personhood. That is what attracts us. Logos manifests itself in the diversity and flowering of nature. We all, no matter what our general point of view is, we all see and experience the beauty in that. That is how Leontief settles the ancient philosophical problem of the one and the many. Modern progress in his mind is totally quantitative. You can have an explosion of some of the most extraordinary technological inventions and developments that mankind 100 years ago could never even dream of. And that could occur at the same time with a complete and total moral decay and moral collapse. For him, the empirical positivist approach to science has a tendency to oversimplify reality, because these guys want to reduce everything to something easily predicted, easily understood, easily communicated, and the best way to do that is to reduce everything to numbers and formula, as if that's the only important aspect of objects in the world. And this is what he means when he says that reality in our fallen world is tragic. It's inherently tragic. It's inherently tragic because no matter what we do, the mediocre followers and bureaucrats and those who can't think outside of their little bureaucratic cubicle always have a tendency to take over. The great founders of science and philosophy and civilization, these are very few. Overwhelmingly, we are surrounded by a herd that does not have reason, does not understand it. They simply react to what they perceive the basic majority believes at any given time, in one form or another, anyway. Civilizations are part of this flowering. Civilizations and different ethnic groups and languages, for him, it's part of the flowering of Logos. The way that the internal reason and rationality inherent in all things, which is the presence of Christ himself as Logos, as the Gospel of John refers to him, it's manifested in all things. But how it's manifested is very different in different cases. And one of the highest examples of this is differences in ethnic, racial, and civilizational tradition. They all follow a general pattern in the sense that all societies need the same kind of things to survive. You know, they need a government and literature and a language and stuff like that. But that's just formal. The content of that is what's extraordinary. Development of life for him is from the most simple to the most complex. Like a lot of people like Danilevsky and others, he sees this threefold approach to all objects, especially human. We start off as an unreflective unity, the most primitive unity of the tribe. There's no real reason or logic that analyzes why they do what they do. They simply do it. But then that gets challenged. It starts to fall apart. The scientific method, so to speak, comes into existence that takes each piece of that tradition and analyzes it. And before you know it, there's no real reason to follow it. It falls apart. Chaos and death come from it. But it's not the end. What happens is that the tradition of the people is not destroyed. It is purified. It is put back together, but this time, logically and rationally, for a real, understandable, and expressible purpose. That's how our human life in society should go. Childhood, adolescence and rebellion, and then finally, settling in our adulthood. That applies to people, it applies to anything organic, and it certainly applies to society. However, there is a final stage there, and that is the stage of decay. Like Danilevsky, like Spengler, Toynbee, so many other writers in this tradition, everything that humans are derives from the organic. But the problem with the organic is that it is tragic. It is tragic because it dies and it rots and it decays. And it can be an awful sight to behold. And when a civilization is dying, and I think that the Western world, the United States in particular, is in its death throes now. They've earned it, to be honest with you. But stagnating, which is the same thing as a society in dissolution, is typified largely by mediocrity and stagnation of all the faculties that society has. One of these technical terms that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk today for Leontiev is complexity. He has a specific technical meaning for complexity, and it means the increase in diverse manifestations of the exact same principle. In a society, it refers to a unified reason for being, a unified cosmion, as Vogel would say, that because of its firm foundation, is able to produce a huge amount of social functions and talents and roles that different people can fill. Like, for example, a society that has reached its highest level of complexity is one that is producing a tremendous amount of literature and writing and education, and in the process is influencing many people beyond its borders. You see places like, for example, Ireland or Japan, relatively small places. I mean, Great Britain is the obvious one. Very small, not very populated areas that, because of their tremendous complexity, are able to influence the entire world. Britain would influence the whole world whether or not it had an empire, because its vigor, Britain at its prime, was producing so much in terms of theology and science and philosophy and technical inventions and everything else, that she became the magnet, almost an Atlantis, to which everybody was flowing. Rome is another very obvious example. They're very proud of being who they are. A complex society, a society at its height, seeks to isolate itself in Leontief's mind. The idea is that it has enough resources, intellectually speaking, to be able to solve all of its own problems without any outside interference. So the point is that a society at its height is a society that it's digging in constantly to its inheritance for the sake of not only solving problems and untangling contradictions, but creating constantly new forms and then improvements on all of those new forms without ever deviating from its main central purpose as a civilization. That, for him, is as close as human societies could ever get to true beauty with a capital B. Now, Leontief, depending on who you read and what aspects of his writing you read, did believe that he was living in the end times. The end times, not in the sense the civilization was decaying and destroying, but really we were coming to the end of the world. And he believes it because he notices that the bourgeoisie, the Western middle classes, have no precedent in history. The idea is, if that mentality wins and takes over everywhere, there can be no regeneration, because the whole bureaucratic mentality of the bourgeoisie is that the whole thought process and the virtues of revitalization are destroyed. If the bourgeoisie will win, there can be no civilization. There isn't the mentality. The raw material don't exist to rebuild. It is the end for man. You can't go beyond the bourgeoisie, because if they take over and dominate all of the thought forms that we use in our day-to-day life, there will be no rebellion, because they've taken away the whole vocabulary of rebellion. And he sees this in a panic, because it's not just that this occurs in Western Europe and in America. He sees that in British colonialism, they're spreading this mentality everywhere. This is unprecedented. Virtue is a thing of the past, because this colonial globalist agenda is based entirely on the world of banking and interest and profit. It will reduce even the most brilliant person to somebody counting coins. All virtues are placed into that context. And so he calls the bourgeoisie, quote, the universal instrument of global destruction, end quote. The idea is, virtue can't be conceived in bourgeois terms, and therefore the vocabulary to rebel against them is slowly being taken away. From a political point of view, what is he talking about? He sees the salvation of Russia in the history of Byzantium. He believes that Byzantium, Constantinople, the New Rome, as we call it, is based around the idea of a strong state authority, a strong sense of social coherence and nationalism, a very strict moral code, and, as is the center of his economics, strong distributivism. He holds that private property is great so long as it is spread to as many individuals as possible, to give man this independence that he requires to build his self-image. This is something that Hegel took very seriously in his philosophy of right. Property, small landed property for families and communes and things, it's absolutely necessary because it provides a buffer. It's a declaration of independence so that that group of people can then flourish in their own way. Jefferson said the same thing. Without landed property or some kind of property that a family or a person owns, you cannot be free. You cannot be free if you are dependent on others for your livelihood. The concept is that the bourgeois mind in Leontief creates these relations of dependence, that you have to go and serve your boss and the stockholders and government officials. You have to serve them or you can't function in society. And then they turn around and they call this freedom. That's what they call it. And Leontief is talking a lot like Orwell long before Orwell began to write. But the Byzantine vision, the Roman vision, strong state, social coherence, strict morals, and a distribution, a wide distribution of private property. Those are four things that no civilization can function without. When one of those four things, or more, begins to decay, the end is coming. He also believes, especially in Russia, but I guess anywhere, that peasant property should be non-alienable. It cannot be sold. It's something that is a close part of the family honor. It's a case in the Old Testament, the Mosaic Law. You know, the extended family is the main social group. It has its allotted land that the extended family owns. Every 7 years, all the debts are canceled. Slaves are set free. And then in the Jubilee years, all aspects of that original family landholding and capital that have been alienated in the meantime return to that same extended family. The Jubilee is central to the Old Testament mission and the Orthodox Church, which alone is the guardian of that tradition. You cannot have a Christian morality without the idea of this Mosaic land code. And so Leontief sees that particular, however, completely ignored aspect of the Old Testament law, which Christians don't even think about. And that's the basis of the Old Testament economics, and it's the reason, in my opinion, why no one reads the prophets anymore. He holds, though, that social inequality is the normal state of affairs. But that inequality doesn't necessarily have to do with inequality of income or land. No, the inequality that he thinks is normal is about talent, ability, and discipline. Everyone should have the same amount to begin, so that everyone has a fair chance. He does believe in a very strict social equality when it comes to economics, but is a complete aristocrat and Nietzschean when it comes to their abilities, their discipline, their creativity. He is very pessimistic about the future of Russia. He's pessimistic about the future of Europe. He believes that the evidence is that the world has largely been forsaken. He predicted, believe it or not, the end of history concept that the Republican, democratic, modern capitalist democracies will begin claiming that they have solved all problems, or at least the ability to solve all problems is present. There's no further progress in the moral and political realm, and therefore the end of history is here. That is being said. That is assumed by both major parties in Congress. or in Parliament in Britain. It's the exact same, and then that's why they can justify the attacks on all countries that happen to disagree with that point of view and impose their rather eccentric brand of liberal democracy on everyone, because this is the aim of history. The aim of history in both the neoconservative and in the neoliberal movements throughout the Western world is liberal democracy and capitalism. That is it. That is the purpose of history. And we're here, and it's the end. There can be no more criticism because there's nothing more to say. That is at the center and the root of this American exceptionalism or the British Empire exceptionalism or any of these ideas that somehow were chosen for this kind of mission. And because of this mentality, Leontief says that the world is forsaken. The only thing we can do is in our own lives, especially in the monastic order and in the state, to do what we can to mock and parody the bourgeois mentality and to use these non-economic actors and forces to make war on these people in any kind of, you know, simple day-to-day way that we possibly can. Leontief protested finally by going into the monastery where he died. This is our mission. This is our struggle. Leontief is one of the great expressors of this point of view and is extremely interesting to read and to study, especially if you're interested in Nietzsche and how Nietzsche can be used. So I appreciate you listening. I think that this has been one of my better shows. I think Leontief is someone who really deserves more attention than he gets. I ask of you, please, to donate if you can. I desperately need the money for my work. I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
To Radio Ariane.